This evening, I'd like to sort of jump the gun on some work we are doing with these Tibetan prints, which I am now studying, because I think they have a bearing on the subject of the evening. In the Kalachakra school of northern yogic doctrine, the heart is represented as what is called the small lotus. It is not the principal chakra of the heart or cardiac area, but a small flower of 8 petals concealed within the very center of the heart focus itself. Now, of course, the lotus with 8 petals has become so intimately associated with Buddhism that we have only to recall that nearly always the deities of the northern school especially are represented as seated or standing upon lotus blossoms. This 8-spoked or 8-petaled lotus of the heart is, of course, also reminiscent of the noble eightfold path, or the mysterious wheel of 8 spokes. And we know that in Buddhism, the number of the petals on the symbolic lotus is arranged to conform with the 8 spokes of the wheel. Now, all this centers in what the Northern School itself refers to as the heart doctrine. And this doctrine is in strong distinction to the highly mentalistic system of Southern Buddhism. Our principal purpose, however, in bringing this out at this moment is a peculiar symbolism which is found in both China and Japan. There is a belief in the religions of those areas, a faith which is quite clearly indicated in the Shingon and the Nichiren sects in Japan and the White Lotus sect of China. It is the belief of these people that when a devout person, or in fact any person, but especially a devout one, approaches death, that a mysterious vision appears. This is a classic vision in Oriental art. Because the term is easier in Japanese religion than in Chinese, where the words are utterly unfamiliar to us, perhaps it is best to use the Japanese term. The dying person is said to receive a vision in which the Buddha Amida, or Amitabha, appears upon clouds, accompanied by 2 bodhisattvas, one on each side. On the left of Amida is the bodhisattva Kanman, Chinese Kuan Yin. And this bodhisattva always carries what is called the lotus pedestal. This is an empty throne in the form of an open lotus, and it is brought to receive the soul of the dead. The deceased person, the moment the transition from this world to the next is complete, is found in or seated upon this lotus pedestal. If the soul is that of a person of no solid spiritual attainment, it is said that as soon as the soul is seated there, the petals of the lotus close around it, so that it is concealed as in the heart of the lotus, as in a kind of lotus womb. In this bud-shaped form, it is transported to the Western Paradise. Now, if this person, regardless of his virtues or his vices, has at any time recited the great formula, Namu Amida Butsu, Hail to Amida Buddha, with contrition of spirit and sincerity of heart, and has acknowledged, even though he has disobeyed, the sovereignty of the law, has acknowledged in his heart that there is truth. This soul, then, is carried in the bud into the other world, where it passes through a second birth. And as its interior consciousness grows, the petals again open, and the soul is permitted to dwell in the world of Amitabha. If, however, the dying person is of advanced spiritual attainment or of greater integrity, then the soul is represented as seated in a Buddha-like posture in the open lotus as it is carried across to the other shore of the mysterious ocean of life. Now, this scene is very, very common in Eastern art. And I think perhaps it is sufficiently interesting, inasmuch as the old teaching, both of yoga and of tantra, of the old Brahmanical lore upon which so much early Buddhism was based, makes a great point of this eight-petaled lotus throne. And it states that this throne represents the heart of the person. Studying the triad appearing in the clouds, as in the vision already mentioned, the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, or Kannan, who carries the pedestal, is always upon the left side of the central deity. And we may also remember, therefore, that it is a left branch of the pneumogastric nerve which touches the pacemaker in the heart as a nerve, and also, by ascent, reaches the brain. This peculiar point may cause us to suspect that the so-called vision is actually a study of the central nervous system with its sympathetic cords, and that Amida represents, in this sense, the mysterious primordial consciousness, which is seated in the heart of the small lotus in the heart, and that this throne by which the soul is carried to the other world corresponds with the Brahmanic belief that at death, the consciousness is gradually withdrawn from the circumference of the body and is focused or brought together in the apex of the left ventricle of the heart, where it then ascends by means of the left branch of the vagus, or pneumogastric nerve, to the brain, and finally departs from the body through what is called the gate of Brahma, or the thousand-petal lotus at the crown of the head. If we can assume an analogy here, I think it is a very interesting one, because it gives us another dimension to this old symbolism, implying, as the Shingon has always implied in Japan, that all ritual, symbol, allegory, legend, and fable had to do with the motion of the principal, spiritual, psychic, and energy currents of the human body. As far back as our studies in philosophy are able to go, as far back as man has left a record of his convictions and his beliefs, the human heart has been peculiarly sacred. We have to realize that in olden times, dissection was unknown, and in most civilized nations, autopsy was not permitted. It was therefore not upon a study of the heart as an organ that ancient knowledge was derived. It was rather derived from a series of observational factors. perhaps supported by a strong intuitional realization that certain processes depended upon certain structure or function for their existence. And gradually, ancient man, without benefit of modern scientific thinking, came to remarkably accurate conclusions concerning the inner structure of his own body. These conclusions were perhaps not entirely sympathetic with modern anatomy and physiology, but in many respects, they were not wrong. In most respects, they were not wrong. And in some cases, and under some circumstances, they advanced in ancient time conviction or belief, which even today we have not yet been able to either prove or disprove, because much of their thinking was exceedingly profound in these areas. Among ancient peoples, the heart was symbolized in a number of ways. In northern Buddhism, it is usually represented by a vase, a very elaborate structure. Not the slender, tapering, bottle-shaped vase of Kuan Yin, which contained the waters of immortality, but a very elaborate Chinese-Tibetan type of urn, often represented in the lap of Amitabha as he sits in meditation. In the mandalas and meditating wheels, this vase is always the dead center of the circle, which in itself is a rather interesting concept. Everything radiates from this central focus. This vase, according to the belief of the ancient peoples, contained the mysterious, subtle energy of space itself. It was not merely a medicine for the woes of mankind. It was the mysterious fountain from which flowed all life, light, and reality. The Egyptians came very close to the same symbolism. For in their manuscripts, particularly the papyri relating to the mortuary ceremonies, the heart is represented as a kind of jar, sometimes with a handle, sometimes without, but nearly always ornamented upon one side by a design symbolizing a human ear. This peculiar vase is placed on the balance of the scale in the weighing of the soul, or the weighing of conscience, in the hall of the twin truths. It is this vase that speaks. This jar describes itself as containing the soul of the deceased. In many other religious symbols and systems, this central mystery is called a cavern, or a place hidden. In the New Testament, it is referred to as a closet, into which the man shall go to pray to his Father in secret. And the Father who hears him in secret will reward him openly. This is the dark closet, the mysterious place. This is Porphyry's Cave of the Nymphs in the Neoplatonic system of thought. This is Zoroaster's mysterious cavern. And it is the Septapana cavern of Buddha, or the Cave of Seven Rooms, in which the initiations into the mysteries of Buddhism were given to the candidates or neophytes. Hermes describes the heart as a pyramid, and in a strange way, it is a kind of inverted one. There seems much to suggest that in Egyptian philosophy, the symbolism of the pyramid was intended to represent the structure of the heart. Adams, in his book, The House of the Hidden Places, devoted to a study of the pyramid, strongly advances this thinking. The heart, then, has become associated gradually with the concept of the heart of a people, the heart of a community, the heart of a civilization, whatever may be regarded as the focal point, the central point the strong point around which all other things are built. This seems to suggest the idea of the heart. If you have visited the countless cathedral towns and villages of Europe, you will see the little cluster of buildings, the town, surrounding the soaring heights of the church or the cathedral. For these people, the church was the heart of the community. And wherever the ecclesia appears in relationship to the congregation, it is the heart. Entering into the church is entering into the heart, symbolically. The heart represents, therefore, the cultural center, the life center, and is associated with all of the essential functions of a people. In our way of life, the same is essentially true, but by our various attitudes, we place different structures in the center of our ways of life to indicate our essential sense of value. To some persons, the home is his heart. To others, business may be the heart. But that which is most cherished, held to be most dear or most valuable, or regarded as the source of the inspiration to good or achievement, or as a symbol of final security against all the problems and mysteries of life, this type of concept is associated with the heart idea. Also, we know that to the Chinese and other Asiatic peoples, certain beliefs were the heart of the matter. Certain doctrines were regarded as more essential than others. And where a certain scriptural book or a certain commentary was more important than any other, it was referred to as the heart book or the heart symbol. The Egyptians, in mummifying their dead, removed certain vital organs from the body before mummification and variously mummified them separately in jars, which were placed under the couch of death. The heart, however, was not removed. The heart, therefore, seemed to represent a kind of tabernacle. It was something too sacred to be taken. In the ancient astral theology of many peoples, the heart became a sun or solar system symbol. It was consequent to assume that what the heart is to man, the sun is to the world. Therefore, as the sun became the radiant center which supported the planets and all the life upon them, so the heart was the radiant center that supplied the life and energy of the body. The analogies can go on almost indefinitely, but they are not our primary purpose, so that I think perhaps we can assume you will read the section and find more of them for yourself. The next point that I think is very significant to us is the fact that the heart is actually only a muscle. The heart in itself can no more bestow life than the brain can bestow thought. Just as the brain is merely a structure, so the heart is merely one of the vital organs of the body, the most vital. Yet in itself, we cannot assume or regard it as the source of the fact of aliveness. Of the heart, a certain point is particularly associated. It is called the pacemaker, and apparently is that area in the heart which is the origin of the pulse. And it is this pulsing of the heart that some mysterious and wonderful way seems to preserve the fact that we are alive. If this pulsation ceases, life ceases. In India, this pulsation is called the drumbeat of Shiva. And in China, the study of the pulse, the study of the heartbeat, was carried to an extraordinary degree, further perhaps than it has ever been actually researched in the West. More and more, however, we are coming to the Chinese point of view. Paracelsus had come to it centuries ago. And this point of view is that the heartbeat is, again, not merely a mechanical process. It is not simply that it beats or that it stops beating. The very process of the heartbeat itself is a highly specialized and very complicated process, even in terms of phenomena. What its cause is not at the moment our consideration with the Chinese doctor. Our present consideration is the story that it tells. The Chinese have found, and other specialists have more or less sustained this, that the beat of the heart differs not only with every person to some degree, but differs continuously within any one person. The heartbeat is an exceedingly important means of diagnosis in cases of sickness. The Chinese are able to identify over 300 ailments merely from the pulse. The patient can put a glove on his hand and put his hand through a hole in a curtain so that the physician can never see the patient or even the hand. And the physician, by placing three fingers upon the pulse in different positions, will be able to diagnose over 300 probable complaints and determine which one or group of complaints is most likely afflicting the patient. This system must have been reasonably accurate because we remember that in China, a physician is only paid while the patient is well. If for any reason the patient becomes ill, payment stops, and it is then the duty of the doctor to hasten the recovery for the sake of his own financial status. This diagnosis by the pulse, however, was in China associated largely with physical complaints, although worry, fear, and things of that nature might also be diagnosed. Today in the Western world, through a series of scientific processes, such as the electrocardiograph and the polygraph, the study of the heart has been given very great psychological consideration. We now know that every mood, every emotion, every attitude, every circumstance which affects the individual can and very often does affect the heart. That the heart is extremely sensitive. That it is just as sensitive to emotional problems as to physical problems. The Chinese have a circuitous way of approaching this. But perhaps they are not entirely wrong. That every physical ailment produces some kind of a psychological ailment. And that every psychological attitude will ultimately set up a series of physical circumstances. Therefore, perhaps the Chinese physician is diagnosing not the physical circumstances alone, but the psychological reflexes of these circumstances, which in their turn do modify the pulse rate, as we know. It is quite easy on a polygraph to detect from the heart when a man tells a lie. In other words, his heart doesn't accept the lie. His heart reveals the truth of the matter, his fears, his anxieties. The heart will frequently reveal guilt because of the agitation which arises when the mind is brought into proximity with related ideas. And the person who has committed the crime begins to fear that he is being trapped into an exposure. The moment the fear comes, the polygraph detects this in the cardiac action. Thus, the heart is an extremely subtle instrument. And the mere beating of it is not its whole story. Now, the heart as a muscle must have some very close tie-in with other areas of nerve reflex in order to be so immediately hypersensitive, even beyond the consciousness of the mind itself. The heart apparently is much more oriented in a realm of subconscious pressures, subconscious instincts, and not entirely on the level of mere conscious attitudes. This brings a very definite point which the Greeks began to explore, but their civilization gradually vanished away before their sciences were perfected in these matters. But later others took up this line of thought, and it is still a rather debatable issue. Does the pulse, this mysterious drumming of the gods, actually originate in the heart? Or is it communicated to the heart? Is the so-called beating of the heart something innate and intrinsic in this muscle? Or has it another cause? And is the circulation of the blood due to the action of the heart? Or is the action of the heart due to the circulation of the blood? Now, this would present a series of problems that could easily become very confused and probably would be regarded with the gravest suspicion by men of science. Yet the fact remains that it is not at all inconceivable that the heart is what it has always been believed to be in the worlds of religion and philosophy, not a source of the vitalizing or activation of the body, but a focal point for energy of a peculiar and particular kind, which is in some way imparted to the heart, and therefore is capable of being separated from the heart by the process of death. Is the death of the body a death of energy, or a separation of energy, as in the case of thinking, where we are not at all certain that the death of the brain means inevitably the death of the intellect? Let us suppose for a moment that we recognize man not merely as a physical body as we see it, but as more accurately and more factually a kind of magnetic field. That man is really a physical body floating in a sea of magnetic energy. That this magnetic energy forms what has been termed the invisible or intangible perspiration, or perhaps may be likened to the mysterious bottle of alchemy, the retort of crystal, in which the processes of transmutation, generation, regeneration, and transformation take place. It was long held and is still believed in Asia that consciousness per se, as itself, is not located in the body, but that more correctly and properly the body is located within the consciousness. That consciousness is not a point but an area. This problem also confronts the student of astronomy. The question as to whether the sun is the source of its own energy. Ancient peoples did not believe that it was. They believed that what we call the solar disk is actually a shield carried on the arm of the sun god, by means of which this deity reflects invisible energy into the visible world. In the Japanese creation myth, the solar deity is feminine, the goddess of the sun. And with her is immediately associated the metal mirror of Shinto. For she is said to reflect the light of heaven upon the face of a mirror, and this mirror is the sun. The ancients used various kinds of glasses, lenses, and mirrors to collect light for the lighting of altar fires. And they took the attitude that the pacemaker, or the pulse center, or the heat center in the heart, is such a convergence of rays, and that the source of this life is not in the heart, but is imparted to it from this magnetic field. This magnetic field itself is in constant motion. This motion includes not only movements of currents and eddies within the field itself, but the primary vibration of the basic substance or minute particles from which magnetic energy is formed. Thus, what we call the pulse beat is really the beat of the magnetic field itself, communicated to the body. And this magnetic field is in a constant process of motion, vibratory motion, which corresponds to the beat of the heart. Thus, the heart would become a kind of island in the center of a magnetic field. In the very early stages of the development of the embryo, the so-called mysterious agent of blood is not clearly differentiated. But ultimately, blood becomes the vehicle of energy. And the arterial venous system extends not only to the surface of the body, but extends as magnetic fields out beyond the body. Thus, the blood and the magnetic field are associated. And it is possible that the blood is the means or medium by which the magnetic essence is conveyed to the heart. However we wish to look at this problem, the question naturally arises as to whether the heart is the source of its own energy, or whether this energy is imparted. And I believe that most thoughtful persons, from the beginning of recorded research, have held it to be essentially firm that this energy is not intrinsic in the heart itself, but is imparted. The great mystics of the early medieval period, who were among some of the most powerful visionaries that we have ever produced, had various descriptions of experiences which they saw of function of body and organ. I'm thinking of St. Hildegard of Bingen, one of the most important and interesting of the Catholic religious mystics. St. Hildegard left manuscripts illuminated with numberless figures and designs of things that she had seen as inner experiences. And these touch upon the problem of the heart. And her concept of it was very definitely that it was a kind of solar center which was sustained continuously from its own field. And that, therefore, the field was the important thing, not the organ itself. She also held that the consciousness in its relationship to the heart was subject to a special kind of interpretation. If it is true, as the ancients also held, and we find in Indian Vedic tradition and lore, that the three persons of the great creative trinity are represented by the heart, the brain, and the reproductive focus, then this trinity would consist of consciousness as the heart or central power, intelligence as the brain focus, and force, vitality, or energy as the negative focus. These would therefore constitute a basic triad. Buddhism, particularly in Japan and China, began the study of what they called the Lotus Gospel. And this was the gospel of the mystery of the heart, which they finally came to recognize as probably the most important of all the mysterious sciences which man could discover, the science of the true meaning of the heart. Now, we think of religion almost always as a heart doctrine, but we think of it largely as a mystical-emotional doctrine. We think of the individual's heart being the source of a kind of goodness, that it is the source of a basic morality, that it is the substance of the truth in him, and that in this sense of the word, his heart means that he is possessed by a certain charity. The heart is associated with love, charitas. It is associated with all types of human affection. But to these students in the olden days, much more was implied than this. They held definitely that the focal point, which we call consciousness, was actually placed in the heart. That in a mysterious way, the structure of the heart provided it with a primary brain of its own. Therefore, that there are two kinds of brains, the mental brain and the heart brain. That the mental brain is the source of intellection. The heart brain is the source of mystical or visionary apperception. That man might achieve knowledge through the brain, but truth only through the heart. That these are different types of structures. So we find also in the old writings the reference to the fact that there are seven brains in the heart and seven hearts in the brain. That in a strange way, the heart, as shown in the old Rosicrucian diagram, becomes a symbol of the solar system, with the sun placed centrally, surrounded by the orbits of the planets, which are found in the structure of the heart itself, and the entire wall of the heart, as in the pictures by Burney, surrounded by and composed of the constellations of the zodiac. Thus the heart is a universe within man. It has the potential of supplying the entire external structure, the body from itself, because it has received into its own nature the essential seed of life, and that this seed of life therefore becomes the base of the livingness of the body which develops around the heart, is supported by it, and in turn, the body becomes the protector and administrator of the heart power. What then would be the nature of the consciousness in the heart? Hermes, in his discourse to his son Tatian, attempts to clarify this point, but probably lived a little too soon to have some of the interesting scientific facts at his disposal. Also, too soon for much of the digestion of philosophy, particularly Oriental thinking, which has more recently come to our awareness. Consciousness is not to be associated with thought process. Consciousness in its own nature, therefore, is not to be penetrated. It is not to be analyzed or examined. It is merely a superior state of awareness, an awareness which seemingly still remains directed primarily toward cause and not toward effect. Therefore, the heart seems to be more aware of things invisible behind itself than of things visible in front of itself. The heart contribution, therefore, is not intellectual, rational, or reasonable in the sense of mental activity. The heart contribution is most expressed and most clearly sensed in the mysterious potential of reality that is lurking within our own natures. The scriptures suggest that as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And this thinking in the heart is not conscious thinking. This thinking in the heart is God thinking man, not man thinking about God. This is spirit mysteriously manifesting through its works. And these works themselves are not capable of comprehending their own Lord and Master. So that when man enters into the heart, he enters into silence. He enters into the great quietude of Lao Tzu. He enters into that silence that came before the sounding, as Beni calls it. And that silence into which the sounding must finally return again to sleep. Thus, whatever this mysterious power that resides in the heart may be, its primary requisite is quietude. It would and must abide in peace. And the principal experience we have of the heart is the capacity for peace, which comes to us. The capacity to have so great an interior sense of reality that without intellection, without argument, without debate, without affirmation or denial, the being experiences the fact of the presence of reality. It is this experience of reality, then, this experience of not only of an existence, but an eternal and significant existence. This experience comes to man. Man then takes hold of it and intellectualizes it. But the experience, the essential conviction, comes first. And this conviction is not thought. It is known by a mysterious experience within the self. Of this, then, we can say, in terms of the definition of consciousness, that in some mysterious way, it is the invisible source of this sense of beingness, this sense of significant, purposed existence, which all things feel within themselves. The loss of this feeling through any circumstance or affliction or despondency of the emotions or mind can result in what is termed the broken heart. This can exist. It is a term, however, which simply represents the loss of this sense of heart value, the loss of the spirit of meaningful life within the experience of the person. Actually, to put any of this type of thinking into any kind of wording is extremely awkward. So we can only, so to say, talk around it and hope that you will catch the point which I am trying to make. Namely, that the consciousness in man contributes no ideas, no news, nothing of a tangible intellectual nature. It merely contributes this sense that we exist, this I am-ness of ourselves, not voiced, not rationalized, but assumed, so near to us that we do not doubt it, question it, or analyze it, but turn from it to doubt, question, and analyze all other things. It is perhaps experienced somewhat in this concept that man is incapable of the experience of death. He is unable to know what death means because he is alive. And it is a series of certainties based upon the fact that we are alive that must be basically associated with the heart system. Now, the moment this system comes into existence, man begins the elaborate process of transforming it. In the Kala Chakra concept, therefore, we remember, as I said, that there is the large chakra located, or the that is the ganglia of the autonomic nervous system, located in approximately the heart region. Then there is within this the small lotus, or the small flower of eight petals. The outer flower, the chakra, is very largely the center of man's sensational existence. It is here that the individual passes into the expression of the entire gamut of his emotional propensities. Thus there are, as we may say, at least two layers to the heart consciousness. Its own innate structure, which remains forever in a state of reality, and its emotional negative polarity, which extends outward into the sphere of the sensory perceptions and reflexes. Therefore, the innerness of the heart may say, I know. The outer part of the heart may say, I choose to believe. Then the mind comes along and says, well, it's my opinion. And everybody has been heard from in some way or in some degree. There can be no doubt that the mind is essentially under the control of the heart. That the mind, therefore, is a subordinate being. The heart will retain function longer than the brain, if the two are separated in any way. The brain's consciousness ceases very quickly, but it is well recorded that the human heart has survived assumed death for an hour or even longer, and that it is quite possible to demonstrate that the heart tissue of serpents, after the heart has been chopped into small parts, the various small parts will continue to show a certain amount of pulsation. Therefore, we are dealing not merely with a structure, but we are dealing with a kind of pull for energy, which itself is pulsing. And it is the pulsation of energy that is communicated to the heart as a muscle. In this sense also, the psychic life of man is very closely associated with the outer or large chakra of the heart system. Our emotions very largely cause our psychic stress, and the mental reaction or factor is secondary. And almost always where you find the mind disordered, the emotions were disordered first. And the emotions, by some ill training which was given to them, gradually dragged down the mind. This is true also in terms of the affections of man. The psychic field with which we are very largely concerned today is therefore an elaborate structure of symbolic reflexes based upon consciousness, even as the mental field is a series of reflexes based upon the released energies of mentation. And we cannot assume that these various degrees of manifestation are identical. They are emanational, one from the other. The lower always being lesser in value or quality. Now let us go back directly to the heart problem, which we have very definitely to consider. The ancients regarded the heart as being a kind of seed. This seed, of course, has growing from it a great tree. This tree being the arterial venous system. So if you lay this out diagrammatically or make a drawing of this structure, of the arterial system rising from the major arteries, in turn rising from the heart, you come to a design that is almost exactly the design of a plant. It has a bulb-like root, which is in some kind of earth. And this plant unfolds, extending throughout the body, where it controls life function. At the same time, we have another tree. This principal tree also grows from a seed or a bulb or a root. In this case, the brain. This is the nervous system. And when laid out diagrammatically, is exactly the equivalent of the arterial system in design, or so similar that there need to be very little adjustment made. Thus, the brain becomes the seed of the nervous system, and the heart becomes the seed of the arterial system. Back in the days when somebody was compiling Genesis, it came apparently to their attention that man in some way had these two trees. Therefore, one was called the tree of life, and this tree of life grew from the heart. And the other was called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and this grew from the brain, which was perfectly consistent, reasonable, and proper. Now, in the course of time, certain things happened in the Garden of Eden which are a scandal to us even yet. So there's no use to bring up this delicate issue. But the fact remains that man was cast out of the garden in connection with breaking the will of deity concerning the fruit growing upon these trees. And if we think a little about this, we can do some rather interesting rationalization. Bainey, the mystic, declared also that there was another tree. And this he symbolized by the peculiar symbol of the palm tree. And we know that the palm leaf is one of the ancient symbols of martyrdom and was also important in connection with Palm Sunday and things relating to Christianity. The palm leaf or the palm tree was the tree of rest in the desert. The palm tree, wherever it appeared, told the wandering nomad of the desert that water had to be there. And while the water might be underground, there was also a limit to the root of the palm tree could go. And usually the palm marked the oasis. Also, the shade of the palm might be the only protection against the desert sun. The palm tree in Christian symbolism, because Christianity arose in a desert region where the palm was one of the great symbols of hope and rest and salvation, became a very adequate symbol for the soul. And in Bainey's writings, the symbol or significance of Christ is clearly pointed that the seed of Christ is planted in the human heart, where it grows up into a great palm tree. And this palm tree was the symbol of the promise, or the symbol of the waters of life, the symbol of salvation in the desert of waiting, the symbol of the promise of peace to those who were suffering from the storms and privation of the great wastes of sand. Therefore, to Bainey, salvation, or the soul, was a third tree. and the soul grew from the heart. And the soul grew from the heart rather than from the brain. Therefore, the redemption of man lies in the redemption of the heart motives rather than in the, conversion of the brain to certain attitudes. This is the point that was made in the Buddhist system, where the soul was taken to paradise if once during life it had truly, sincerely, and devoutly accepted the mystery of truth. Now, in this system also, there is an interesting thing, because somewhere in space is the great lake of paradise. And in Asia, this lake of paradise is a wonderful pond, very peaceful and beautiful. And the surface of it is covered with lotus flowers. And every time a human being performs a beautiful act, a new bud is born there. And that is the bud that will later be brought to him as the throne to carry his soul to paradise. In other words, it is his own good deed that becomes the throne or the lotus blossom, which is brought to him when the time comes for his soul to make the transition. So for every good person unfolding in the world, there is this lotus in the great pond of eternity. And as he grows in this world in wisdom and understanding, the lotus opens in the invisible world. And the kind of throne he will sit upon in the infinite is determined by his merits here. The same thought is behind Danish mysticism. Namely, that in some mysterious way, by a process of induction, the heart lotus opens as the result of the growth of soul power. That within man, the entire alchemy of his relationship to eternity is determined by the heart center.